My question was, can we stop entropy?
No, Zach.
Seems like something you'd want to stop.
Hello, and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast by the penitentially young, contritefully hip, and meatlessly lay editors of America Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by just Zach Davis.
Not just Zach Davis. Come on.
Only Zach Davis.
Okay. You're joined by Zach. By me. Hello.
Yes. We are missing Olga Segura very much this week.
Yes. Olga is with our producer, Eloise, in the Holy Land, and a number of America staff members. America's on its annual pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
Yeah. So America, in addition to making a magazine and podcasts and videos, also leads pilgrimages in the Holy Land, in Spain, and in Rome. I've been on the Spain and Rome. I have not been on our Holy Land trip. So no. I'm very jealous of Olga right now.
And so you can follow their journey at journeys.americamedia.org.
Yeah. They're also like Father James Martin's posting some really good Instagram photos and giving us major FOMO.
Yeah, it's
because
true.
Because they're just like chilling by the Sea of Galilee.
Yeah.
Wish I was there.
We're just chilling by the subway rats here in New York. Another spiritual experience.
Yeah. So what's on tap, Zach?
Nothing.
And who are we talking to this week?
This week, we're talking with Elizabeth Acevedo, who is a slam poet and author of the upcoming novel, The Poet X, which comes out next Thursday. March 6th, that's Thursday, right?
Yeah.
So we actually recorded this interview earlier this month, so you'll hear Olga's voice. Liz did an event here at the American Media offices in New York where she did a poetry reading, and it was really great.
Yeah. And you can see videos of that on our website at americamag.org, so definitely check those out.
I have just been told that March 6th is a Tuesday, so The Poet X, Liz's new novel, comes out Tuesday.
Okay. March 6th.
I know. February is a weird month.
It is.
28
days. Yeah, I can't believe it's already about to be March.
How's your Lent going, Ashley?
It's going well. So listeners will know that the host of Unorthodox gave us our Lenten penance, which was not engaging in political fights, which, to be honest, is not that hard for me. I don't really get into political fights because I hate confrontation.
Well, and I feel
am
like
a moderate.
I feel like most of the fights you get in, I provoke. I start. And if I'm not allowed to start them.
Exactly. So I've kind of given myself other things to, you know, make it a little tougher. So no sweets, which, you know, is standard. And then I've also tried to stop listening to podcasts on the subway. So it's kind of like a mishmash of all these different things.
Okay.
But yeah.
Have you been keeping it up? Have you found it difficult? You're in the...
Yeah, no, I found it difficult. Oh, I've also been doing the Jim Martin Examine. Have you been doing that?
I have, yes.
So that's his new podcast that you can, you know, get wherever you get your podcasts. And it leads you through the Examine. It's 18 minutes long and I really like it. What about you? How is your Lent?
I'm actually finding the political thing very difficult.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to abide by their rule of any and all kind. Mm-hmm. So I'm not actually even retweeting anything that I agree with politically.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I haven't quite taken stock of the spiritual mm-hmm. lessons that have come out of, you know, not engaging.
So there's no part of you that's like just relieved to be taking a step back?
Not really, no.
Okay.
Not yet. We'll see.
All right. Got another month to go.
Yes. And listeners, if you're, you know, struggling through your Lenten thing, keep on keeping on, I guess, because there's still a long ways to go.
I know. Yeah. Let us know how it's going. Email us. Tweet us. But now, Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to.
Yes. Dozens of Catholics were arrested yesterday as they were protesting in Congress. This was a follow-up to Monday's National Catholic Call Congress Day, which we talked about on last week's Signs of the Times. Tuesday was a National Day of Catholic Action on behalf of Dreamers. And so dozens of Catholics, including men and women religious, were arrested near and in the U.S. Capitol. They were protesting with signs and with banners, and they were singing Hail Marys and chanting. I don't know if you noticed this. They were chanting, Paul, why do you persecute me?
Oh, wow.
Which is scripture. But all referring to Saul, why do you persecute me?
Yeah.
But also
Paul Ryan,
who is Speaker of the House, and saying he should be doing more to protect Dreamers and not using them as bargaining chips, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Not the first time Paul Ryan has been chastised by nuns.
No, he's got to be getting sick of that. Of note, of the 30 or 40 arrests, 8 were religious sisters, Sisters of Mercy. So, as one person on Twitter put it, the sisters were being led away because religious sisters lead the way.
Oh, that's great.
Often.
So true.
Yep. What's our next story, Ashley?
Yeah. So in Michigan, inspired by the really horrific case of Larry Nassar, the USA Gymnastics national team doctor who was recently convicted of serially abusing children who he was supposed to be taking care of, the Michigan legislature is considering a law that would extend the statute of limitations for people who were abused as children. And the Michigan Catholic Conference has said that this is of concern to them. This is the lobbying arm of the Catholic Church in Michigan. They have not come out against this specific proposal, but in the past, they have opposed legislation that would lengthen the amount of time that people who have been abused can still bring a civil or criminal case against their abuser.
And right now, someone who's been abused as a child has until their 19th birthday.
That's not a lot of time.
No.
And the law would move it to 48. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. And one of the Larry Nassar's victims told members of the state Senate that the median age for women and men to disclose sexual abuse is 41 for men and 38 for women.
Yeah, that really jumped out to me too. We don't want to pass judgment on the Catholic Church in Michigan yet because they're still considering the facts of this specific bill. But we thought we would talk a little bit about the church's general response to legislation like this.
Yeah, it's really frustrating and something that has come up in the office before. There seems to just be this generational gap in sympathy for the church, because we weren't around for the first abuse crisis, but for us it's why in the world would the church oppose a bill like this?
This is the argument I have heard, is that if you basically get rid of the statute of limitations, you are opening the door to people bringing cases going back to the 60s and 70s where key witnesses and evidence might not really still exist. So you have this limitless potential for litigation that will just bankrupt the church and, keep the church from having resources to spend on its very important social ministries and helping the needy. So that's the argument that often gets made. In California, they extended the statute of limitations, and the Catholic Church has had to pay out over $1 billion in settlement fees.
Yeah.
But, there's a reason that they have to. They're not a innocent victim here.
Right. And the church in other cases, so there was a case in Chicago just late last year where the court ruled on a false accusation and found the church was innocent, and they were going to make the accuser, they were considering having them pay court fees at a minimum. Mm-hmm. And in that instance, they said, look, this is super rare. Both victim advocates and the church all around said, this doesn't happen very often. And even if you had a case where, bringing back instances from the 60s or 70s and key witnesses are dead and et cetera, these are all things you can sort out in a court of law judged mm-hmm. by a jury of your peers, right?
Yeah.
So it's frustrating.
Yeah. And it's more than just bad messaging or bad PR, right? People our age, it really is something that makes it hard for us to respect the authority of the church.
Right. And people will say the more money we pay out, the argument is social service centers will be closed and all these different things. But that's not anyone's fault but our own, us being the church community. And mm-hmm. we're included in that, right?
Yeah.
And so we should feel the hurt that we're causing. And by blocking legislation like this, it feels like it's getting in the way of reformation, of conversion. And so that's what I've been thinking about, especially in this era of Me Too and the spirit of Lent and penance mm-hmm. that we're going in right now. I think that's something the church should be thinking about.
Yeah. What's next, Zach?
So Catholic bishops in Texas have issued a directive that parishes, priests, diocesan groups should cut ties with one of the state's largest pro-life organizations. The Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops is asking all of its affiliates to stop inviting members of the Texas Right to Life group onto their premises to speak, and has urged, you know, Catholics to take everything that is directed from legislator scorecards to evaluations of legislation with a grain of salt, because they haven't been matching up with what the bishops think is, you know, a good pro-life cause.
Yeah, and this group has criticized the Catholic Church, right, for some of the positions it's taken on legislation?
Yeah, especially in regards to end-of-life care. They've accused the church of, you know, just basically allowing death panels, which is not necessarily true, because Catholic moral theology on end-of-life issues is quite nuanced, and whether, you know, so that's going to be reflected in some of the legislation that gets passed, and it's not at all accurate to say that we're advocating for death panels.
Yeah, so the divide here is that the Catholic bishops recognize that, like, we can work for incremental change, and the Texas Right for Life group does not see that as acceptable, and has a more like a kind of like a purity litmus test on anything they're willing to support in terms of laws. Is that right?
Yeah, and also they haven't been necessarily great stewards with some of the money they've been using, because they'll push through legislation that may blanket ban abortion in the state. That's going to get struck down by a court right away, and then the organizations that push through that legislation are going to have to pay for the fees of the people that sue to get the legislation struck down.
Right.
And so there's an issue of being good stewards with your money, because that doesn't help anyone. And if anything, it sets the movement back some.
Right. What struck me as interesting is hearing, you know, the Catholic Church in Texas, which I don't think anyone would accuse of being anything but very pro-life, you know, making the case for nuance and working for incremental change. Because I think there are some Catholics who feel that they are unfairly tarred when they work with, say, like a pro-choice Democrat on something either, you know, supporting women's health or like early childhood initiatives. But you know, from their perspective, they're supporting mothers in a way that might lead to less abortions, but they still get called out for cooperating with evil for doing that.
Yeah, there is this instance in Illinois this past week too, because as part of National Day of Action and National Call-In Day on behalf of Dreamers, Cardinal Supich called his senator, who is Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, who was recently barred from communion by Bishop Paprocki of Springfield. And so some people on the Twitter sphere or wherever were saying, I can't believe Cardinal Supich, you know, called this senator who has this pro-abortion stance to help Dreamers, which I guess the logic is being you should only work with pro-life senators to get protection for Dreamers, which is not a practical solution, right?
Yeah, no, I that was disheartening. So everyone else, keep calling your senators, no matter what their
position is on a number of issues.
Yes, because this is about the Dreamers, not about the senators. Okay. Now on to something lighter, because that was a lot of heavy stuff. Zach.
So this past week, there were some great photo ops that came out of the Vatican, because Versace and Vogue were there. And by that, I mean Donatella Versace and Vogue's editor, Anna Wintour. They were both at the Vatican to help promote the Catholic Church's role in shaping fashion.
Yes.
And so they were hosted by Cardinal Ravasi, who is the minister of the Vatican's culture department, forgetting the exact phrasing.
I felt very uncultured because everyone was posting these photos and I had no idea who any of these people are.
Yeah, same. But they like...
But they are great pictures. Cardinal Ravasi looks very...
I mean, he's a hip guy.
Yeah.
But he does look out of place a little next to, you know, the very fact... They've got this like very... Both of them have fashionable dresses on, and there are these displays with like golden papal tiaras, and it especially looks jarring in the era of Francis when like all of this like elegant dress has been stripped away
yeah.
a little bit. No. And so, just,
I mean, Ravasi looks sharp in his cardinal, you know, get up, the black and the red, always in fashion.
Very classic. Very classic. But it's to promote an exhibit in New York at the Met that's called Heavenly Bodies, Fashion in the Catholic Imagination, which opens this spring. Which,
and that we're all going to try to crash, right?
Yes, I can't wait for that. We're going to have a link to some of these photos in our show notes, so you should definitely check them out. But those weren't the only great photos that came out of Rome this week.
That is correct. Rome had its first snow in 6 years, which was made for some great photos. You know, there was, and it was a lot of snow.
It was a lot of snow.
Six inches or something, which they were not prepared for. I read somewhere that they brought in the army to help clear the streets because, like, they just do not get snow. But everyone was making the most of it. There were priests. In the news stories, they say the priests were having a snowball fight, but, like, these were clearly priests that were not have never had a snowball fight because they were just kind of, like, tossing the snow in the air. It wasn't really aimed at anyone.
But it was cool to see them in their black cassocks and the various
hats,
priestly
headgears.
Hats that in headgears that Catholic clerics wear, all kind of running around in the snow in St. Peter's Square, which, you know, Rome is not, you know, St. Peter's is normally in all white, but it's not like, Rome's kind of a dirty city. So it's not really the blinding white that snow can bring. And so that was also just like really fun to see.
Yeah. So, yes, we will have pictures of that as well in the show notes.
Perhaps maybe it was Anna Wintour who brought winter to Rome.
Oh, Zach.
So today we're excited to welcome Elizabeth Acevedo. She is a slam poet and author of the upcoming novel, The Poet X. Welcome to Jesuitical, Liz.
Hi, how are you all?
We're great.
Pretty good, pretty good.
Happy. Fantastic. Glad to be here. Thank
you. We're very, very excited. So Liz, you combine all of your many talents in The Poet X. So to give our listeners a sense of your work, could you read a little bit from the novel?
Sure.
We really liked the poem Spoken Word. Yeah, so if you could read that one.
So to contextualize it a little bit, the main character, Xiomara Batista, is a secret poet. So she hasn't told anyone that she's a poet, but she writes in her journal. And this is the first time that her teacher has invited her to poetry class, to a poetry, club, and is now going to show her a little bit of what they do in the club. And she calls it spoken word, which Xiomara didn't know was a thing. When class starts, Miss Galliano projects a video. A woman on stage, her voice quiet, then louder and faster like an express train picking up speed. The poet talks about being black, about being a woman, about how beauty standards make it seem she isn't pretty. I don't breathe for the entire 3 minutes while I watch her hands and face, feeling like she's talking directly to me. She's saying the thoughts I didn't know anyone else had. We are different, this poet and I, in looks, in body, in background, but I don't feel so different when I listen to her. I feel heard. When the video finishes, my classmates, who are rarely excited by anything, clap softly. And although the poet isn't in the room, it feels right to acknowledge her this way. Even if it's only polite applause, my own hands move against each other. Miss Galliano asks about the themes and presentation style, but instead of raising my hand, I press it against my heart and will the chills on my arms to smooth out. It was just a poem, Xiomara, I think, but it felt more like a gift.
Mm. Wow, that was great. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
So you decided to write this book, or you first decided to write this book when you were a teacher, yes?
I was an eighth grade English teacher.
Now, were you thinking about your students throughout this writing process?
I think the impetus at first was my students. I was teaching in a predominantly Latinx school. I was the only teacher they'd ever had of Latinx descent who wasn't teaching Spanish. Hmm. And so all of a sudden they had this English teacher who their parents could talk to, who has similar cultural background, who was bringing in literature that felt familiar, like the places they were from. And I had one student who looked at me one day and said, "We read all these stories, but none of them feel like us. None of them feel like they're about us." And so I went out and bought all these books by Latinx authors and came back and she zoomed through them. And she wasn't my top reader. She wasn't even at grade level at the time, but all of a sudden she found books that interested her.
And then 2 weeks later, she's like, all right, I read all the books. What's next? And I'm like, oh, no. Like, I don't have anything. But it made me realize we need more stories on the bookshelves that reflect those students.
Was that your experience, too, growing up?
I would say it was. I mean, I was a voracious reader, and I loved Little House on the Prairie. I loved, you know, Because of Winn-Dixie. I loved Harry Potter and all these books. But I do think there was a little bit of me that wondered, where are my stories? And that's probably why I turned to hip hop and music, because that was where I saw my community. That was where I saw the people I knew and grew up with. That felt like home. I didn't think books were about me. I could read them, they were for me, but I couldn't write them and they weren't going to be about me. Music was about me.
Yeah, that's super relatable because I'm 28 years old and I still, most of the literature that I've read my whole life doesn't look like me. Like even the cover of your book, I'm looking at her and I'm just like, her hair looks like mine. Her hair looks like my sister's, you know? Yeah. So that's, I can only imagine what that feels like to be a student and to be able to kind of like look at this and see yourself. It's super profound.
I hope so.
I was surprised by how Catholic the book was. Like, it, like, I knew I had read the blurb and I knew that she would be dealing with the tension of her mother's religion and, like, her kind of pulling away from the church. But I was like, wow, this is a really Catholic YA novel. Was that something that you intended? Like, you brought your own experience with religion into that?
You know, I don't know if it's what I intended. I've read a lot of young adult that deals with religion, and I can't say it's my favorite genre. Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes it can be reductive in how the topic is approached. It's either you are or you aren't. You like are really about, you know, your faith, or you are shying away from it, but it's not really explained why. And so with this story, I knew I wanted a parent who has found strength and power through the church and has found identity through the church and can't understand why their child doesn't see that. And I wanted a child who has a lot of questions and doesn't know how to say, I am not ready for this and I don't know if I ever will be. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the central conflict. Mm-hmm. And so it rippled out throughout the book, whether or not that's what I wanted it to do. But I hope that it's it feels universal whether someone is Catholic or isn't Catholic. But to speak to your point, you know, I write all these poems and then like we'll go back and be like, wow, this is really Catholic. The iconography, the language.
Yeah.
I think my first poems were being in church, was listening to prayers. And so I can't help that seeps in.
Right, right.
We just had this survey of Catholic women in the United States who all self-identify as Catholic, but maybe don't go to church, maybe disagree with a lot of church teachings, but still find some meaning in that identity. Would you describe yourself as Catholic, a cultural Catholic? How do you describe that tension in your own life?
You know, this is a tough question. Olga asked me this before, and I was like, you're going to put me
on
the spot.
But you gave such a great answer, so I was like, we're bringing it back.
I do feel like Catholics are always trying to figure out if you're also Catholic.
Yeah.
It is like a weird thing we do. I don't know if it's good or bad.
It's my Catholic school guilt. I have to keep asking you this question.
This is hard for me. I mean, it's not really hard for me. It's hard for me to say because it feels like I'm admitting something that doesn't feel safe to admit, particularly because my mother is still very involved in the church and I recognize what it is for her. And I know that for her to hear the answer to this would really hurt her. But I'm not a practicing Catholic and I wouldn't consider myself Catholic. I think I believe in God, and a lot of what I am trying to consider at this point in my life is what were the practices in place in the Dominican Republic and in the people brought to the Dominican Republic before colonizers came. And I'm interested in exploring those faiths and in what that might hold for someone like me who is really thinking about decolonization, while also recognizing that that's not my mother's answer, and what she finds in the church is so critical and has been so important for her. And so that's what I got.
So with that, the novel's still sort of divided into very biblical sections, right? So you've got in the beginning was the Word, and then the Word was made flesh. Mm-hmm. What were you trying to evoke with that type of frame?
I think I've always been moved by the idea that, you know, two or more people in a space talking about God, that is church. And I think about...
I think that Jesus guy said that.
Jesus guy had a lot of good words, let me tell you. That man was a poet. And I love that that poetry is often thinking about universal truths, is thinking about what is the heart of the human experience, and that oftentimes people are talking about God whether they say it or not. And to bring in a space where multiple people can share what's on their heart, that to me feels like incredibly powerful and what church does for a lot of people. And so those sections where really see Omada thinking about poetry, right? The word becomes flesh was when she finally embodies her poetry. Mm-hmm. In the beginning was the word, was like, in the beginning I started writing because it was the only escape I had, and so that it is applicable in every regard to her life, right? I hope. That was yeah. a goal. I don't know if I succeeded. That's what I tried.
You're talking about the way poetry functions. It reminds me of like the way I think about prayer. Mm. Also, sort of like directing your thoughts at these things and feeling and being in community. Has poetry ever felt like prayer to you?
I think there's something really powerful, probably less when I'm performing. Mm-hmm. I think some poets can do it when they're on stage and really feel like they have entered a realm that is just beyond the flesh or beyond the moment. There have been times when I have watched someone read a poem that I have felt so moved and so connected. In a way that feels like almost this bubble in time. And then you know, the poem's done and you wake up and you're like, all right, I'm at a bar and like, and I shouldn't be crying, right? But that to me probably feels like that idea of language elevating us to a space that feels beyond this reality.
Yeah. Has your mom read the book?
You know, she flipped through it because it's not out yet. So she flipped through an advanced reader copy that mm-hmm. I had. And I think it's hard for her to realize like fiction, because my poetry is tends to be more autobiographical. And she's read
and this
that.
Is not?
This is, I think there are moments that I pulled from. But no, like mm-hmm. I was never made to kneel on rice. My mother was
is that
super.
A thing?
I was made to kneel, but not on rice. My mother was made to kneel on rice, but I was just made to kneel for like an hour and during Thanksgiving and things like that, if I ever talk back.
It's an old school practice.
Dominican moms are very fierce.
It's a very Caribbean practice, the kneeling on rice. And I think a little old, probably before our generations, although I've heard stories since reading from this, I'll read and people will come up to me and say, I was made to do that. It's a punishment. Where was I going with this?
Your mom.
Your mom. Did she read it?
So she loves that I was a poet. She was like, yes, go on stage. She wanted me to be famous, get on Univision. Like, she had all these dreams. So for her, she's like, this is amazing that you can say these words in front of people and we don't know where this came from. Like, you just had this in you. So she loves that. But I think the character's mother is a little different. And so she gets nervous when she's like, well, people are going to think this is me. Mm-hmm. Because in my poetry, when I write about my mom, I'm writing about my actual mom. Yeah. And so she's like, I don't understand what you mean by this is fiction. I'm like, well, you didn't do this, so it's fake. That's what I mean.
I made it up.
I made it up. So I have to keep telling her, remember, I made it up.
Like, couldn't you tell when I was lying when I was a kid?
What makes this novel so great for me is that I see my mom and Tiomara's mom. I see the ways in which I had to struggle with a lot of what my mom believes, you know, and just kind of being like, I can still love her and we can still do this, even if we completely disagree, you know? And I think that's, like, we've talked about this, but how important is it for you to kind of refute a lot of the stereotypes that are associated with not just Dominicans, but Dominican characters in literature?
This is hard because I think when you're talking about refuting, then you have this audience in mind that is present when you're writing. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it's less about, I'm going to prove these stereotypes wrong, and more about, I am writing the experience I know, and I am affirming that my people deserve to be on the page and on the screen and in music, and we exist. Mm-hmm. We exist, and we're here.
Right.
And it's less about, like, if you thought that we're just here and we're just baseball players who like love plantains, like, no, I don't care about that audience member, honestly.
Right.
I care about the folks who are coming to this and want to see themselves. And if other folks come and are like, oh, this is an interesting story that I didn't expect, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. But I'm not here to offer a counter argument or a counter narrative. Mm-hmm. This is the only narrative I know.
Right.
This is a narrative that is true to me. And I don't want that audience in my head or in my ear. Mm-hmm. And revision, maybe I'll think about, is this stereotypical? Can I flip this? Is this what is expected? But I think when I'm first writing, it's like, mm-hmm. I want a young person I once taught who is of Latinx descent to look at this and be like, yeah, that's me.
Have you sort of engaged the book with any young people yet?
Yeah, I've been able to read it at a couple of high schools. I read it at a bunch of colleges I've done. So, you know, kind of young adult-ish, depending on what year they are. And I read it. I read a piece of it at the middle school I taught at. So they were the first ones to see the cover when no one else had seen the cover. Mm-hmm. And I went back and read a section. Completely different students because mine have graduated. But yeah, it's been
so
nice to...
middle school, is that kind of the age? I've got a lot of middle school teacher friends in my life. So
yeah, I think eighth grade and up. Anything younger than that, some of the topics might be a little bit older.
What about eighth grade Catholic school?
I suggest that department heads buy a book and see if it fits. I mean, I think there are difficult things that are grappled with. And I don't know if Xiomara ultimately ends up, she doesn't do confirmation, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't, and this is one of the big conflicts in the book, is she doesn't end up going through with. So I'm not sure what the reception is going to be from different, you know, Catholic spaces. If it's good, I don't know what folks are going to take this as. When I was talking to Olga, I was like, by the way, the book is blasphemous and so am I. So I don't know if you want to do this interview.
I was like, yes, please continue. That's actually why I was even more encouraged to do it. Well, Liz, this has been great, but we got one more question for you.
Okay. Here
we
go.
We ask all of our guests, and it tends to stump some people, but I'm excited to hear. I've been very excited to see how you respond to this. So if you can canonize anyone, living or dead, Catholic or non-Catholic, who would it be and why?
So like, who am I making my saint?
Yeah. Yep. It could be anyone. It could be Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, whoever you want.
These are good saints.
Yeah,
I like
there you go.
Dogs, it gotta be Frida Kahlo. She's just like Saint Frida is a G, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So my confirmation name is Joan.
Okay.
I was like, when I found out Joan of Arc was like a saint, I think that's true. At least the research
it
I did. When I was like, this is my confirmation name. But if Frida had been a saint, I think I would have probably gone with Frida. I just think she's so fierce and was on the continuous path of figuring out the woman she wanted to be without subscribing to the notions of womanhood at the time. And I think that is such a powerful message for like always searching for yourself, regardless of who's in your ear. So,
okay.
Although Joan was bad too. I don't know.
She doesn't need your help.
She's already there. Yeah.
She's good. Yeah. I'll keep her as my confirmation name, but Frida would be my saint.
Okay, so Saint Frida. Well, Liz, thank you so much for talking to us. And your book, The Poet X, is out next month, correct?
March 6th.
Okay, so listeners, go out and get it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right, before we get into listener feedback, I just wanted to bring up, maybe you started listening to Jesuitical as part of your Lenten penance. Or maybe it was your Lenten penance last year, and you're looking for another podcast to engage you this
Lent. I don't like talking about ourselves as penance.
But we have to accept the fact that it's true. So America Media actually launched a few different podcasts this Lent to help people get engaged in various ways in their spiritual life and with the Psalms. There's The Examine with Father James Martin, which Father Jim leads the listener through the Examine prayer, which is really nice. We've all been doing it as part of the show. So if you've thought about praying the Examine, and if you don't, that's the Examine, I should say. I always speak in Jesuit speak. But the Examine is a centuries-old prayer practice that helps you notice where God was in the little moments, in the big moments in your day. So if you've thought about doing the Examine before, this is the time to do it. There's also The Word, which is a regular column in America, but for Lent, they've put out a daily podcast reflecting on the Psalm of the day. So at the daily mass readings, they take the Psalm from that, and there's a reflection written by Betsy Cahill, who's a scripture scholar, and it's really nice, set to music, and it's really quick. So it's a nice way to check in and out for the day. You can find both of those podcasts and all of America's podcasts, including us at americamagazine.org/podcasts.
And you can support Jesuitical by going to patreon.com. We launched this last week. We have an account on Patreon, which is a way that you can support us by, you know, being a part of our community. So you commit to giving a certain amount of money each month, and that gets you things like Jesuitical swag or a chance to video chat with us, the host, once a month. Or if you are a VIP, you can come into studio for a recording and we'll provide drinks.
And we are providing full cuts of our interviews. So there's some good stuff.
We already have two of those up, right?
Yeah. And there's more coming. And so if you're like, man, wonder what else they talked about.
Yeah. Because there's more. We can't fit it all in 40 minutes.
Right. So check it out at patreon.com/AmericaMedia.
And we want to give a very big thank you to the people who have already supported us through Patreon. Our patrons or Patreons, I'm not really.
Patrons.
Patrons.
Not patrons.
Not patrons. At least not during Lent. So we've got super fans, which include Allison Coulson, Catherine Addington, Jeff Trussell, Keith Bourgeoin, and Matthew Kyrish. And Nicholas Frege.
And our ambassadors include Carlos Mesquita, Claudia Macaluso, and Michael Kelly.
And our VIP is Andy Stolk. Thank you so much, Andy, and everyone who have supported us. We love making this podcast, but we're going to need some financial support in addition to all the moral and loving support you give us each week in order to keep doing this.
We did manage to make it a year before we had to...
justify ourselves.
Yeah, so that's exciting, but now it's time.
And another thing we should mention about Patreon is it has like a messaging board, so it's a really cool way to like interact with our listeners and for you to interact with us. So Nicholas Frege wrote to us about how much he appreciates the Signs of the Times segment and how he even called his congressperson to support Dreamers after listening to that segment of the show. So we're hoping to use this as a way to like get suggestions about what kind of news stories our listeners want to hear about, or maybe guests that they want to hear from.
Or drinks. Yes. So all types of recommendations and things that you want to hear about.
Yeah. And now it's time for Consolations and Desolations, the part of our show where we talk about where we found God this week and where it was... and where it was harder to find God. What do you have, Zach?
So this week I've got a consolation. So as we've mentioned before, as part of our Lenten practice, we're doing the Examine podcast with Father James Martin. And been in Jesuit education and in Jesuit ministries for a little while now, and the Examine is always a big thing, and I've always shied away from doing it. We talked about this last week with Brother Luigi about, you know, being hesitant to engage in prayer a lot of the times, and that was definitely the case for me, especially with this prayer practice, because part of it is reflecting on where you messed up during the day. And I was always afraid to dwell on that for too long, which, you know, says something about me. Mm-hmm. But my first experience with it was overwhelmingly going through my day and noticing that God is present in so many moments throughout my day that I don't even give a second thought to normally. That's the consolation. And I know that sounds a little pious, but it is what it is.
Oh, shut up. No, I've had a similar experience. It's just like, I don't know, especially since we spend so much of our time at work, just like going through the workday and just like interactions with all of my coworkers. I just like feel very grateful for all of those.
Are you viewing all the times I interrupt you during the day as moments of grace or?
Yes, they pull me away from my work so I can reflect on God as he is in you.
Oh, thanks, Ashley.
Yeah.
Ashley, what do you got this week?
I also have a consolation. So one of my fears or insecurities is that, you know, my closest friends all live in different, you know, besides you guys, my closest friends from previous stages of my life all live in different cities. All my family lives in the DC area. And I just like fear that the distance is going to, you know, get in the way of those relationships. But this past weekend, my best friend growing up asked me to be her maid of honor for her wedding that's coming up. And she lives in California, and we only really see each other one time a year now. But it was just like a very good reminder for me that even though I don't have to like earn her love by like constantly being in her life or doing things for her or like, you know, just reminding her I exist. Like, mm-hmm. She's not going to forget that I exist. She's going to love me because of who I am and give that love freely, just like God does. So that was just a good reminder that, like, I'm lovable without having to like remind people that I exist by like being right in front of them. So that was good.
And if God, and if like our other humans do it with us, imagine, yeah. And like, it's always nice to think that God loves us even in an even more perfect way.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Thanks, all right. God.
Should we wrap?
Yes. Jesuitical is brought to you by American Media and produced by Eloise Blondio.
This week, though.
By Eric Sandrup, SJ, who also provides Jesuit formation. Our editor is Noah Levinson. Engineering and design by Angelou Jesus Canta. And one third of our adverbs this week, our favorite adverb, meatlessly, was provided by Patrick O'Neill, who also left us an iTunes review. So thank you, Patrick. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show, and please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave us a review. And send us your questions, feedback, cocktail recipes, and tell us where you found God this week at jesuitical@americamedia.org. For America Media with Zach Davis, I'm Ashley McKinless, missing Olga, and we will see you next week.